After this, the Lord appointed 72 others and sent them two by two ahead of him to every town and place where he was about to go. He told them, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field. Go, I am sending you out like lambs among wolves. Do not take a purse or bag or sandals, and do not greet anyone on the road. When you enter a house, first say, 'Peace to this house.' If a man of peace is there, your peace will rest on him. If not, it will return to you. Stay in that house, eating and drinking whatever they give you, for the worker deserves his wages. Do not move around from house to house. When you enter a town and are welcomed, eat what is set before you. Heal the sick who are there and tell them the kingdom of God is near you. But when you enter a town and are not welcomed, go into its streets and say, 'Even the dust of your town that sticks to our feet, we wipe off against you. Yet be sure of this, the kingdom of God is near.' I tell you, it will be more bearable on that day for Sodom than for that town. Woe to you, Chorazin. Woe to you, Bethsaida. For if the miracles that were performed in you had been performed in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago, sitting in sackcloth and ashes. But it will be more bearable for Tyre and Sidon at the judgment than for you. And you, Capernaum, will you be lifted up to the skies? No, you will go down to the depths. He who listens to you listens to me. He who rejects you rejects me. But he who rejects me rejects him who sent me."
Well, Andre, thank you very much indeed for reading for us, and thank you very much for having me over these last couple of weeks. It's been a great joy to be here, and I hope I might get invited back one day, and it's been great to see the work getting going. Our subject over the last couple of weeks has been Christian mission and evangelism, which I realise is quite a contentious issue, and I'm sorry that I won't even this week be able to get round to tackling the sort of contentious side of it. You might like to pick that up in questions at the end. But what I've been wanting to suggest is that Christian mission and evangelism is right at the heart of true Christian discipleship. And it's right at the heart of true Christian discipleship because it's right at the centre of the agenda of Jesus Christ. I want to issue something of an apology. We have gone rather slower than I had intended. And therefore, like National Express or Southeastern, we have been running slightly behind schedule, so I'm sorry about that. You may have heard of the commuter service recently, back in the autumn. Do you think you could ask those chaps to be quiet, Richard, and then we can crack on? They may have heard of the commuter service a couple of autumns ago, where there was a delay for 20 minutes, and the driver came on the line and said, "I'm terribly sorry, there's been a bit of delay on the service, I'm afraid there are leaves on the line." There was then a pause, and he announced, "Unfortunately, they're still attached to the tree." Now, my excuse, however, is that this is a bit of a journey of exploration for me. I've not taught the whole way through Luke's Gospel, and so I've been exploring, and as I've come through this passage, I've decided that actually it's more important that we delve into the detail than that we forge on regardless. Now, we saw last week that Jesus deliberately chooses 72 disciples and sends them on before his face. The phrase of being sent before his face in order to make preparation for him is highly significant. It comes in chapter 9, verse 52, and I'd like you to take hold of the green Luke's Gospels and turn to page 36. And you'll see that though it's not translated like that, it's actually there in verse 1 of chapter 10. The Lord appointed 72 others and sent them all on, literally, before his face. And it's significant because, and turn to this, back in chapter 7 and verse 27 on page 26 at the top of the page, it was John the Baptist who was the messenger sent before Jesus. And you'll see he says it again there, "Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way for you." So now, Jesus, having had John the Baptist go before him, selects, first of all, James and John, two apostles, and then three other typical disciples
who he sends on before his face to prepare his way for him. And then in chapter 10, verse 1, he commissions 72 others, i.e. like the three, and like James and John, who again he sends on before his face to make preparations for him. And the implication is that these 72 are in the line of John the Baptist, who went ahead of Jesus to prepare the way for him. We saw that the number 72 is significant because there were 72 nations of the world back in Genesis 10. And therefore what we're seeing here is what you might call a global workforce being sent out symbolically representing the nations of the world, who Jesus is commissioning with all the authority of a John the Baptist to go in front of him, typical disciples, to take the message of the arrival of Jesus the King before his face. Now that conclusion is supported by James and John, because they see themselves as walking in the footsteps of John the Baptist and Elijah. When they're rejected, they ask the fire to be called down from heaven. Jesus refuses to do that, but it's clear that they see themselves as people in the order of John the Baptist and in the order of a great prophet Elijah, in the order of a great spokesman of God. And we suggested last week that it's as if a window is being opened where there is opportunity for people like you and me across the world to respond to Jesus and to receive forgiveness from him. He will come in judgment one day, but now an opportunity has been opened up. We're in extra time, injury time if you like, and there's an opportunity for forgiveness. And he sends out these workers in order to make his arrival known. Now, I wonder if you actually have grasped hold of the significance of that. It's something that's been sort of weighing very heavily on me over this last week, that John the Baptist was described as the greatest person born to a woman by Jesus. And now Jesus sends out his disciples with the same commission as a John the Baptist to go before his face and make preparation for him. It's hugely significant for any person who calls himself a Christian that right at the centre of Jesus' agenda is to make his name known across the world, holding out the offer of forgiveness to people who will turn to him. He summons disciples to costly proclamation of the gospel of Jesus. Now last week we had 5 bullet points and I only got through 2 of them, and we saw that the work Jesus is summoning his disciples to is an urgent work and we should pray for it. That's in verse 2. He said to them, "The harvest is plentiful, but the labourers are few. Therefore pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to thrust out labourers into his harvest field." I wonder what you've done about it if you were here last week. The harvest is plentiful, there are few labourers, and he tells his disciples, it's a straight command, to pray earnestly for labourers to be sent out. I wonder how that's affected your prayer life if you call yourself a Christian. Has it had any impact over this last week? Have you found yourself praying earnestly for God to thrust labourers into his harvest field? I sometimes say to the staff team at St Helens, you know, when was the last time you gave half an hour to pray urgently for the Lord to thrust labourers into the harvest field? This is, if you like, the other Lord's Prayer that he commands us to pray. Now, the staff team are paid to say their prayers by the congregations at St Helens, so I've got every right to tell them they should be doing it. Sometimes say, when was the last time you set aside a whole hour to pray urgently? When was the last time you set aside 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour to ask the Lord to thrust out labourers into the harvest field around Moorgate? It's a global mission. It's at the heart of Jesus' agenda. He chooses these representative 72 and sends them out. It's also a dangerous affair. We should expect opposition to it, and we mentioned that last week. Look at verse 3. It's an extraordinary picture in verse 3. go your way, behold, I'm sending you out as lambs in the midst of wolves, the good shepherd sending his flock into the teeth of the opposition. The good shepherd sending out his labourers as lambs in the midst of wolves. At St Helens, you lawyers will be glad to know that we have a risk register. And one of the items on the risk register is reputational risk. And apparently, the main threat to the reputation of St Helens is at least substantially the rector of St Helens, which is me, which I find rather offensive. But there you are, there it is, in bold on our risk register. And they want me to go on media training in order to kind of, you know, make sure that I can handle it if ever there's a sort of threat along those lines. I don't know if I'm the main threat, but anyway, I'm one of them. That I have to have media training. Now, I've got nothing against media training, I can see the sense of it. But I said to the church family, if ever there comes a day where you think the risk to the reputation of St Helens through my preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ will be nil, you are following somebody other than Jesus Christ. Because he sends us out as lambs in the midst of the world. So the world will hate the message that you take to it as you go back to your office and tell them of Jesus Christ. They'll hate it. Lambs in the midst of the wolves, a dangerous work. It's a focused work, and here we move into new territory in verse 4. As Jesus says, carry no money bag, no knapsack, no sandals, greet no one on the road. Verse 7, remain in the same house, eating and drinking what they provide, for the labourer deserves his wages. Don't go from house to house. Don't keep looking round for better accommodation. Eat whatever they offer you. Don't reject it because of your scruples about food laws and cultural norms. And verse 10, if they reject you, shake the dust off your feet and move on. Now, some of this is unique to Jesus' day. We know that because later in the Gospel he tells them that they are to take money with them. And in the Acts of the Apostles, they are told they are to settle down and plant churches and so on. So not every Christian becomes an itinerant, travelling mission worker. So there is much that is unique. But you cannot avoid the focused nature of this work. They're not to get distracted by their own scruples and religious customs to what, when it comes to what they will or will not eat. They're not to consider their own creature comforts. And if they come into a house and see somewhere more comfortable next door, to move next door. No, they're to stay where they were welcomed. They are like Jesus, to seek out the spiritually hungry and invest time and energy there. And to then to move on when they've done the job. There's an urgency, isn't there? There's a priority to the work. I think of one of our mission workers who worked in a country where dog meat was quite regularly on the agenda as a delicacy when she went to visit a home and she was welcomed in. Sort of poached poodle and smoked Scotty dog and that sort of thing. And she asked one week, what when she was there, just had a particularly sumptuous casserole, what kind of dog was it? To which she replied, she received the reply, medium size, which I thought was rather amusing. But it is interesting, isn't it? Given the accusation of missionaries stamping their cultural norms on the cultures to which they go, Jesus actually tells them not to do that. When they go to a town, they're to eat the food that's given before them, whatever their own religious scruples. It's striking. This is a bit of a foretaste of Acts 10 and Acts 11, for those of you who know it. They have one goal. It's highly focused. And they are to make known the arrival of King Jesus and offer peace in his name. Does this mean we're to give up on people in our family and in our office who reject the Christian gospel and just say, well, you've rejected it, I'll have nothing to do with it? I think sometimes it may mean that we think, well, is there somewhere else, someone else, who I take the gospel to? Keep praying for them, but don't force it on them. It certainly means we should seek out the hungry. And regardless of their professional position or their social standing, we should seek to share the gospel with them. Interesting to me how in the credit crunch, quite a lot of the business guys at St Helens have said, because business opportunities have been limited, we've had to go to new markets. and one or two of them would be rather sort of snootily saying, I'm going to countries I've never even heard of, and being rather sort of snooty about the whole thing. The interesting, isn't it, here how Jesus seems to suggest, well, if they won't accept you, just move on somewhere else. And it's struck me, I wonder if our limited harvest here in this country and in this part of the world is sometimes because of our restricted horizons. You know, do we assume that the harvest has to be from the educated metropolitan elite? It'd be so comfortable and convenient if it was. What if God has given up on the educated metropolitan elite because they're so arrogant and they've rejected the gospel of Jesus Christ again and again and again and again? What if he's actually not primarily working there? And actually he's working amongst the prison population or the inner city urban underclass or the Chinese in the country? Is our harvest limited because our horizons are restricted? I think of Ronnie Wilcox, who was one of the church wardens at St. Helens for many years. He was one of the most successful jute traders. I'm not quite sure what jute is, but anyway, he's one of the most successful jute traders in the world, I take it. He was the most successful one in the city. He must have been in the world. And, you know, obviously made shed loads of money. Where did you find him on a Friday evening? Every Friday evening, he was in Bethnal Green in a youth club sharing the gospel with teenage boys and girls, right up into his 70s. That's where you'd find Ronnie. I mean, his Daimler was parked outside, but Ronnie was in the youth club sharing the gospel with the lads and girls in a Bethnal Green youth club. What did he do with his money? Oh, he gave, I mean, literally millions to enable Christian good news to be passed on 20 to 30 year old young people. That's what he used his money for. A huge, I mean, his footprint can be seen today, if you knew about it, all over the world as a result of his unrestricted horizons, not just sharing the gospel with my little clique, but being prepared to go, to eat whatever is set before you, to go wherever you're sent, to take the gospel to the cleaners in your office, to the people on the canteen. I was having a great chat this morning with a guy who lives just opposite us, who's got one of these tags on his leg because he's, you know, he's not allowed out after 9 o'clock at night. And we've been developing a bit of a friendship over this last 2 to 3 years, out of an incident that is I can't tell you right now because it's too complicated. Anyway, so it's just how limited are our horizons. It's a focus work. Fourth, it's a salvation work. And here I want to finish on this point, and I want to do some hard work. I want to look at verse 5 on page 36. Whatever house you enter, first say, peace be to this house. And if a son of peace is there, your peace will rest upon him. But if not, it will return to you. Now, that phrase, peace be to this house, is shorthand in the Gospel of Luke for offering forgiveness. And I want to show you that because there's so much confusion about it. Turn back to chapter 1, page 7, and verse 67. Turn back to chapter 1 and verse 67. Here is the father of John the Baptist speaking about John the Baptist, who's about to be born, or has just been born. Verse 76. Did I say 67? I meant 76, page 7, bottom right hand. And you, child, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will, notice this, go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation to his people. What is this salvation? In the forgiveness of their sins, because of the tender mercy of their God. So what is salvation? Forgiveness of sin. Now turn the page. How is this salvation described? Verse 79. To give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace. So what is salvation in Luke's gospel? Oh, it's the forgiveness of sins. How is it described? Peace. That's peace with God. Of course. Because once I've had my sins forgiven, then God's anger towards me has been dealt with, and my hostility towards God has been forgiven. Peace with God. Peace with God in Luke's gospel is shorthand for a restored relationship with God through the forgiveness that Jesus wins on the cross. Turn over the page now to chapter 7 and verse 49, and I will confirm this for you. And it's on page 27. Here is a sinful woman who meets Jesus. Look at verse 49. Jesus, 48. Jesus says to her, "Your sins are forgiven." How is this forgiveness of sins described? Verse 50. He said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you." Salvation. "Go in peace." So what is salvation in Luke's gospel? It's the forgiveness of sins. What does the forgiveness of sins result in? Peace. That's peace with God as a result of my sins being dealt with. So this mission force is to go out into the world. It's a symbolic number, 72. Saying to the house, and it's shorthand, I don't believe they actually walked in the house, said peace be to this house, and then walked on somewhere else. But explaining that it is possible for you to have your sins forgiven. That's what I said to this young man this morning. It's possible for you to be brought into a friendship with God. It's possible for God to enter into your life and to begin to radically change you. It's possible to have the whole of eternity opened up to you as a result of having your sins forgiven. I'm afraid the young man didn't kneel down in front of me and ask Jesus to come into his life and forgive him there and then. But that's the message of the gospel. So then the message that Jesus' disciples are sent to proclaim is the message of the forgiveness of sins. Jesus is not offering an end to global conflict. Jesus is not offering an end to stress or the promise of a kind of emotional, psychological nirvana. Actually, we're going to be sent out like sheep amongst wolves. That's hardly an end to stress. He is offering the forgiveness of sins so that I can be brought into a right relationship with God. Now, that is the currency then of global mission, and nothing could be more important. I don't know if you saw yesterday that they published the Forbes celebrity rich list. I was hoping to see some of your names on it, but I didn't spot any of you there. Apparently Oprah Winfrey on $315 million a year is the richest celebrity in the world, with Simon Cowell only creeping in at a mere number 11. Press the fast forward button 50 years. Of what value is Oprah's $350 million a year going to be to her? Why, her eternity has begun now. If she's received forgiveness, she will be in eternity forever. If that's not a complete double, what's it? With the living God. If she's unforgiven, she will remain under the judgment of God for eternity. So do you see the currency and the importance of it? You know, press the fast forward button on your own life. Most of you look about 12 to me, so press the fast forward button for 70, 80 years. You know, of what use is anything else the world's got to offer to you? But if you've received forgiveness of sins, then eternity is opened up in relationship with God. Now, very important that we get this straight, because so many church leaders, and some of the churches I suspect you go to, have lost confidence in the verbal proclamation of the good news of forgiveness. And they think that actually what we should be doing is offering all sorts of other things to people. That's self-help courses, marriage enrichment. None of those are bad things to offer and help people with. But the currency, the core issue to do with the Christian faith, is the forgiveness of sins and the opening up of eternity. I think of a mission some of our lads went on the other day, and they came back and said one of the colleges, as part of their mission, had decided not to speak the gospel, but to cook cheese toasties so that when people came in from clubbing in the evening on Saturday night, they could show the love of Jesus. Now, that's not evangelism and mission. That's cooking, actually, if you want the honest, straight truth of it. Or Love London, for example, where people came to London and cleaned people's cars and scrubbed the walls and that sort of thing. Well, that's not mission. That's social work and cleaning. Yeah, nothing wrong with doing it. But unless you've actually spoken the words of forgiveness of sins and offered that, you're not involved in the mission of Jesus that he commissions these people to do. Well, I've pretty much finished. Just notice, finally, that it is a divisive and decisive work. And even as I have been speaking, division and decision, I suspect, has been taking place. Even as I've been speaking. Just look down at verse 16. Jesus says to these 72, "The one who hears you, hears me. And the one who rejects you, rejects me. And the one who rejects me, rejects him who sent me." Now, I tried this yesterday. I haven't actually briefed anybody. Perry, you are not allowed to accept this, okay? But I have here a cheque. It's blank, and it's for £50,000, and it is from the St. Helens. It's signed, and it's from the St. Helens. Because I haven't briefed Perry, I've got to tell him now, you are not allowed to accept this, otherwise the illustration won't work, because I will be chasing after you as you make your way to the bank to try and get it back, okay? You've got to refuse it. Perry, I have been given a cheque by Brian O'Donoghue, church manager of St. Helens. It's blank, and it's for £50,000. Would you like it?
No.
No, thank you. Oh, there you are. See, so he had the offer. He had the offer. I was holding very, very tight, I have to tell you. He had the offer, but in rejecting me, he rejects the £50,000 signed by Brian O'Donoghue. Perry, will you receive forgiveness of sins? Jesus offers it to you in his name, because he died on the cross, and I come to you saying, don't answer this, I come to you saying, will you receive Jesus and the forgiveness he offers? Him who rejects you, says Jesus, rejects me. Perry rejects that. Oh, division is taking place and decision is happening. Which is why Jesus says earlier, woe to you, Chorazin, woe to you, Bethsaida, for if the mighty works have been done in you, had been done in Tyre and Sidon, which were notoriously wicked cities, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. It'd be more bearable in the judgment for Tyre and Sidon than for you. And Capernaum, which was a classic city, town that thought highly of itself and felt they were sophisticated and would have said, oh, we're raised up to the heavens, we're so sophisticated and so on. And Jesus says to them, well, will you be exalted to heavens? As you reject Jesus, you will be brought down to Hades and hell. For if you reject the offer of forgiveness, what hope is there for you? What hope is there? Here then is the mission, the global mission that Jesus summons his disciples to. An urgent work, we should pray for it. A dangerous work, you will expect hostility to it. A focused work, don't get distracted from it. It's the most important thing you've been given to do in the city, far more important than anything else anybody asks you to do. All your career in the city is to be engaged in this work. It's a salvation work. You're actually offering people forgiveness that will decide their eternity. And where they spend eternity will depend on how they respond to what you offer them. It's a decisive and a divisive work. And you will find, even as I'm speaking, division's taking place. I hope everybody is actually stepping over onto one side with Jesus. What a job to be doing. I've got two kids staying with me in my house on work experience at the moment, and they're all hugely excited. You know, they've got their new suits. One of them's working for one of these wretched American banks and is all excited, and they're trying to hook him in and turn him into a sort of economic materialist, you know, and get him under the press and into the slave with the shackles on. So anyway, here he is, but he's like a little puppy. He's so very excited, and it's absolutely wonderful, and he's reading up the night before and going into work, and then they're telling him he's going to have to work longer, and one day he'll be very, very rich, and so he's all excited about the whole thing. But can you imagine, you know, imagine this job. To be commissioned by the King of Kings, your Creator, to go before the face of Jesus, the King, and to offer people a message and the reality that will change their eternity. It's nothing more exciting. Nothing more exciting, and I hope you will be thrilled by it and engage in it wholeheartedly as a number one priority for the whole of your time working here in the city and in your retirement till the day you die.